What can it be that calls me to this place today? This lawless car ballet, what can it be? Am I a baby pigeon sprouting wings to soar? Was that a metaphor? Hey, there's a dollar store. Look!
Hello and welcome once again to my favorite thing I get to do. It's another breakfast all day a la carte interview. And the person sitting across from me today wrote that song you just heard because he wrote and directed, co-wrote and directed Ralph Breaks the Internet and wrote Zootopia and the original Wreck-It Ralph and Cedar Rapids. But more importantly, he's a really great old friend of ours and his name is Phil Johnston.
Hi, Christy.
Hi.
Nice to be with you.
I'm so happy to see you.
You too.
You sound very enthused.
I am. It's early. It's breakfast, right?
It's breakfast all day.
Trade secret.
Here.
It's not breakfast time. It's much later in the day.
Well, it depends on what time you woke up.
It's a dirty lie here.
It's a metaphor, breakfast all day.
Oh, that's nice.
Right.
That's, okay, all day. Good. Fair enough. Good.
We don't actually eat on this podcast.
You gave me water and nothing more. It's a terrible breakfast.
I could have.
Not healthy.
I could have made scones.
You could. You didn't.
But then people would hear us chewing into the mic.
ASMR. It's a big thing. Some people get into that.
You're the second person actually on this show to mention that.
Ugh.
It's like a fetish?
It's so troubling to me. I hate it.
Can you explain what it is?
It's people that like that listen to that and find comfort. I don't think it's a sexual thing. I think it's, or maybe it is, I don't know. But I think people like hearing that or like the sound of eggs being beaten. Like it's just, it makes me want to throw up just thinking about it.
See, the fact that we've already gone there about 2 minutes, not even, into this conversation just shows what kind of talk this is going to
be. It's going to be great.
It's going to be great. So we're going to talk about everything. About your career, about your early life, but I'm going to start out by asking you what I ask everybody when they come on this show. How do we know each other?
Man, that's a good one. We lived in the same building in Brooklyn on 12th Street in Park Slope. we shared many, many fun nights and days on the roof. We had the view of Manhattan from the roof of our building. We had some very weird, hilarious New York City neighbors, including a ping pong playing couple that lived. Were they next door to you?
The Epsteins were directly next door to us.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, that were a constant source of tumult.
Yes.
and comedy in,
yes,
your life.
They were straight up hoarders.
Yeah.
And they would fight in the street.
They would. And they had a ping pong table in their apartment.
Because she was like a ping pong champion.
Yeah. And a Scrabble champion. Yeah. But you and Jill and Chris and me were all best buddies, yeah, before kids, yeah, and then had kids around the same exact time. So what, 15 years?
16 years.
Yeah. Way back.
We go way back. Yeah. It's funny because one by one, the couples that we knew in that building, it was this cool loft building in a part of town where everything was brownstones. This was the one street that had lofts. And like one by one, all the couples had kids.
Yeah.
And then the four of us were like, we're not having kids. Screw that.
Yeah.
We want freedom and travel. And we were all runners and we liked our bodies and we were happy. And then we moved out to LA. We moved back to LA and then across the country from each other, within 2 weeks of each other.
Yes.
I got pregnant and your wife Jill got pregnant.
That's very true.
Transcontinental seed.
And we... Yeah.
Powerful stuff.
Very powerful.
Yes.
And then we moved out here 7 years ago, and here we are.
There you go. So our,
reunited.
It's so nice. And our babies were each other's first buddies.
That's true.
Your daughter and my son,
yeah,
in the womb. So there you go. Well, good. But long before you were Academy Award nominee, Phil Johnston.
Well, long before. Wasn't even a dream.
Yes. For all of eternity now, though, you will be Academy Award nominee.
And please refer to me as such. Going forward in this conversation.
You get better parking in places now, don't you?
I don't get anything. Oh, I did get a certificate. I wonder where that is.
Yeah.
I have it. It's in a little folder. I'm literally just now thinking, I wonder where that is. I should frame it, right?
It matters.
It does.
It's a big deal.
I have no idea where it is.
Okay. Well, we'll find it after this conversation.
Thank God.
So let us start at the beginning, though. You were saying that the glimmer of being, you know, the filmmaker of your stature that you have become to be did not even occur to you a long time ago. Let's talk about the very, very beginnings. You were born in Minnesota.
Born in Minneapolis. Lived there till I was like five, raised mostly in Wisconsin. Went to University of Wisconsin, majored in journalism, worked in TV news for 9 years, all over the Midwest, Rochester, Minnesota, Omaha, Des Moines, Minneapolis, which is why, the other reason we were such good friends, because your husband is a TV news producer. Right. We had this TV news background. And, I was almost 30 when I went back to film school, which is what at Columbia, which is what brought us to New York.
See, I love that story. And that's so crazy. You've totally jumped ahead for me in time, but I love all of that because it's amazing to me that you made that leap and I want to get to that point. But did you, as a kid growing up, did you love movies?
I did.
Okay.
My dad was an Episcopal priest, and there was a guy at his church that owned or was something high up at the Marcus Theater chain, which was a Wisconsin theater chain. And as a result, we had a pass to go to the movies every week. Like, it was this little card, and we got a new one every year, and I could go to the movies for free at all the Marcus theaters. So I went at least once a week, sometimes twice a week, throughout college, or high school, rather, and I think the guy died possibly in the 80s, and so the card ended in 1988, but I would just cover it up with my thumb, and I used it deep into the early 90s. Whenever I went home, I would use my Marcus Theater movie pass.
Cheating with the card that you got from your priest dad.
Yeah. Yeah.
But to see film, it okay.
As sins go, it's not the worst.
It was to better yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
And your dad's a reverend and your mom's name is Beverly, and so they are known as?
Rev and Bev.
I love that so much. I love that Jill just refers to them as Rev and Bev. You're Phil and Jill, and we're Chris and Christy.
I know.
So we have no room to talk about cute names.
So twee. The whole thing is just awful.
So what are some of the movies growing up that you saw that really had an influence on you?
You know what? I was talking to someone recently. I remember the first movie I just freaking loved, was On Golden Pond.
Wow.
That's serious. I know.
1981 that came out, right?
Yeah, probably. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I like Star Wars a lot, obviously. And we were just talking about Dumbo. I love Dumbo and Pinocchio and Jungle Book and stuff. But like the first movie I really remember sort of feeling something like on a deep emotional level was On Golden Pond. Yeah, I was probably 9.
Yeah.
9 years old.
I wonder what it was about that film that connected with you.
I think the kid sort of being a sass talker and Henry Fonda reminded me of my grandfather a little bit, sort of an old smartass and him getting lost and while he was looking for blueberries or whatever. I remember just being terrified of, oh my God, this is an old man. What's wrong with him? And feeling such emotion when she found him, like, it was, I don't know. And it's not like I love melodrama now or that kind of sort of tonal thing. But as a kid, something about that movie really, really spoke to me.
Maybe you knew even at a young age that these were pros.
Yeah,
you know,
I bet.
Doing their job.
I bet.
And did you ever see that Jane Fonda documentary that came out, I want to say last year, Jane Fonda in Five Acts?
No, I haven't.
She talks about the scene where she's playing opposite, you know, her dad, of course, and she puts her hand on his hand and he can't look at her. He's like going to cry. He can't look at her. And all of that is totally real.
Ugh.
Like he didn't know she was going to do that in that scene.
God.
And so there's all that fraught real life father daughter tension going on.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's amazing. So what is the name of the town in Wisconsin where you grew up?
It's called Neenah, Neenah.
Okay. Where is that in relation to anything else?
It's kind of closest to Green Bay. It's like 40 miles from Green Bay, kind of between Green Bay and Milwaukee.
And how big is Neenah?
Tiny, like 22,000 people, paper mill town, paper and steel. They make maintenance hole covers, sewer covers. You can see Neenah Foundry, Neenah, Wisconsin, all over the world.
What was it like growing up in Neenah, Wisconsin?
I mean, Howard Hawks is from Neenah.
Okay. That's a good one.
Yeah. I think he lived there for a year or something, but that's sort of a claim to fame. The library did a Howard Hawks retrospective a few years ago.
Okay.
You have these beautiful old mansions that the paper barons kind of owned and then a real blue collar base. So it's a town that really lived and died with the paper industry, which has sort of fallen off, as so many industries mm-hmm. have in the Midwest. And it's a beautiful town on Lake Winnebago. Being a preacher's kid, I was sort of in the middle between, there's some real wealthy people there and then some like the mill workers and their kids. And so I kind of lived between both. Like, we had no money, but I was, my dad being a preacher was, you know, kind of a respected man in the town. And so, our status wasn't really based on class, but there were sort of big class divisions in the town as I think about it.
Were there expectations of you to behave a certain way because you were the preacher's kid?
I suppose there probably were. I'm like 9 years younger than my closest sibling, and my brothers were both more screwed up than I was, so I sort of skated by as the youngest kid. But you're always, to an extent, certainly when you're in church, like on display a little bit. So we would fart on the church pew and laugh when it echoed and that kind of thing, get in trouble for those sorts of things.
Was your dad strict?
Not exactly.
No.
I remember thinking he was, but mm-hmm. now that I have little kids, like right. he was fine. Mm-hmm. No. My mom was the typical church wife, you know, though, who was very, very kind and loving and very, very godly. Like, my dad in many ways sort of had more human traits of getting pissed off and swearing in traffic and stuff that. And my mom was more angelic and kind of the more calm water. And my dad was more of a not exactly what you would imagine a priest to be necessarily.
Interesting. More like Ethan Hawke in First Reformed.
Oh, yeah.
Drunk, tormented.
Yes, using barbed wire to flagellate himself.
Spoiler.
Man, I love that movie.
That was an amazing movie. He should have gotten nominated for that.
That was... I put it in my top two or three of the year. That movie, why didn't everyone just go nuts over that movie? And why didn't the screenplay win? Like, that was so good.
Because Green Book is supposedly better?
Well, I mean, it was so original and so, I mean, it's freaking Paul Schrader, so.
It is. No, it's devastating. Yeah, and I'm happy that it got nominated for anything, but like, that's... top Ethan Hawke performance.
Oh, man.
It should have been nominated.
Unbelievable. He made a movie, too. Did you see Blaze?
Blaze was so good.
Which was a great movie, too. Right. That dude that played Blaze, I can't remember what his name is, but he was amazing. Ethan Hawke getting
Ben something.
All the love that he deserved last year? Like, he did two phenomenal films.
And then he was also in... Oh, God, I'm going to forget the name of it. And a friend of mine produced it. Let me look it up. But Charlie Sexton was great as Townes Van Zandt in that movie, too.
Yes.
Ethan Hawke. This is not good podcast time. What was it called?
Anyway, it was called Blaze.
I'm blanking on who it is, though. I'm looking up the guy who starred in it. Ben Dickey, because he's actually like...
Oh, yeah.
A singer.
He's, yeah, exactly.
Anyway.
Is he related to Dale Dickey?
Oh, maybe. Good question. We can look that up on IMDb too, right? While we're here, he's from Little Rock, Arkansas.
So maybe she's Southern. Great actor.
She is. So you're in high school. You're growing up in small town Wisconsin. You love movies, but you went to Wisconsin to study journalism.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, here's the thing. I did theater throughout, high school, and I wanted in the front of my mind to be an actor, to be on Saturday Night Live. But I simply didn't have the balls. Like, I remember looking up where auditions were for Juilliard, and there was one at in Chicago. And I don't think I ever really just raised my hand and said, yep, this is, I want to go do this, and I'm going to do it. Come hell or high water, I'm going to do this. I didn't have the balls. Basically. And I think I thought about acting as opposed to filmmaking because I don't think I even knew what filmmaking was, honestly. Like, I wrote a lot. I kept a journal. I knew what writing was, clearly. I knew what screenwriting was. But filmmaking and kind of how it worked and how one even did that for a living sort of naively never occurred to me. So the thought of being an actor made more sense to me. Just based on, well, I know what that is because I'm in plays, you know, but I wasn't going around making movies. I was just sort of taking them in.
What plays did you do in high school?
did, Brighton Beach Memoirs at Attic Theater, where Willem Dafoe got his start.
Oh.
I actually saw him at the Oscar luncheon. So we're both for, he's from his town called Appleton, which is right by Nina, and introduced myself because my mom had sent this article to me from the Post Crescent paper saying Fox City's natives vie for Oscar gold. And it was an article about me and Willem Dafoe.
That's so cute.
And I'm like, hey, you know, my mom sent me this article from the Post Crescent. He goes, oh, are you the guy from Nina?
Oh, that's so nice.
Someone sent me that article too.
That's so nice.
Which just cracked me up.
You're meant to meet.
We still have these roots, you know, in this weird little town. So
it's Midwestern nice.
Yeah.
It's real.
Yeah. I did two plays by this Milwaukee playwright, Larry Hsu, who was really funny. He did one called The Nerd and one called The Foreigner. Some Alan Ackbourne, some Molière, some, you know, Hello Dolly, Guys and Dolls. You know, the typical, well, not all typical. Some of it was a little off, I guess, off base for what typically is done at a high school. But, you know, that kind of thing.
It was a broad base of stuff.
Yes.
So the acting thing you weren't quite ready to do, but you felt ready to go into television at some point.
Yeah.
On air. Did you always know you, so you're a journalism major. Did you know you wanted to go into television and did you know you wanted to be on air?
No, not necessarily. I did newspaper and broadcast journalism as my major. And so it was really where I got the first internship. I tried to get an internship at the Chicago Tribune. I didn't. I ended up getting one at WMAQ in Chicago. And that's just sort of how it happened, how I got into broadcast. And I think why journalism made more sense is because there is a very clear ladder that you climb. I mean, you started a small town paper, a small town TV station, you get your resume taped together, you send it out and you move to, you climb to the, you know, the bigger city and then eventually end up in New York at the network or whatever. So there was no particular mystery to it. Whereas, again, like, I don't know why I wasn't more curious about how do you make movies? Why don't you do that? I'm happy to have lived my 20s doing that. I just wonder what was wrong with me. Like, why I was so dumb that I didn't think, oh, yeah, you should go do that. Because that combines all the things you love about storytelling and performance and everything else.
Right. But eventually, I would guess that curiosity that comes with being a journalist would serve you in creating characters, in telling stories.
Yeah, totally. And that's why I'm really happy that I did it, you know. I mean, you know, covering small towns or whatever, that the weirdos you meet and the way you kind of, your skin is thickened by, you know, deadline pressures and mean bosses and psychopaths you work with and photographers who are, you know, drunk drivers and whatever whatever else comes along with it, you know.
What was your smallest market that you started out in?
Rochester, Minnesota, which was like, I think there are 200 and something markets in the U.S. That was like 146, I think.
Chris started out in Laredo, Texas.
Ooh.
He was a sports anchor in Laredo, which was market like 191 or something like that.
Ooh, I'd like to see some of that tape.
Yeah. Oh my God. He's so cute. He has like these like button down shirts with short sleeves and he looks like he's 12.
Yeah. Covering. He has a very young face.
There
now.
You go. Wholesome. And yes. Yeah, but yeah, so we, and you know, I started out at the Shreveport Times. So we all started out small and then got bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
So you rattled off earlier on of all the markets that you were in.
Yeah.
So mention those again. How many were there?
Well, Rochester was my first job. I was the morning anchor / weatherman.
Oh my God.
Yep.
Were there green screens back then?
Yeah. I think it was a blue screen. And I was young looking too. I had like very round face and looked like Bob's Big Boy kind of on the air.
Can you look at video from that time anymore or do you just cringe and die?
I haven't looked at it in years and I would cringe.
Your kids are going to want to see someday.
Yeah, they will. They will. From there I went to Omaha and worked for a station in Omaha and one in Des Moines that both shared me and I covered Western Iowa.
Oh my God.
I was the bureau chief. I was the only one in the bureau. hence the chief.
Were you one man banding it? Is it you with like a tripod and a deck? Because there were decks back then.
Yeah. No, I worked with a photographer.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is that where you met Jill? Your wife?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Jill was the morning anchor in Omaha. I was the Iowa reporter. So typically wouldn't be on her show unless there was some natural disaster in which mm-hmm. like now the floods in Nebraska and Iowa, that's all the area I used to cover.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of flooding always happened there. The Missouri River would dump its banks and destroy all this farmland. So the only time I would ever be on the air with Jill was if I had been up all night and out in the field, and then she would toss to me out in the field and like, I saw her naked last night.
Were you flirting on air, like, to make everybody else feel uncomfortable when
Never.
They were watching?
Far too professional for that.
Jill, I'm standing here in the middle of devastation.
Yes.
But I'm thinking of you.
But you look devastating this morning. You minx.
So this is like 20-something years
yeah.
ago? What year is it?
90, Rochester, 94. Omaha 96 to 98.
Okay. So about 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So then did you just keep following each other to different markets?
So then I got a job in Minneapolis at a great station called CARE.
They are well known. They are
very
good.
Very good station. Mm-hmm. Actually, to this day, does some really amazing storytelling. And Jill then got a job on Food Network. And so she worked very briefly in Minneapolis, but mainly was doing this show on Food Network and
called
The Best Of.
That was a cool show.
It was a great show.
Describe the show.
They did it for 6 years, covered over 1,000 restaurants. Basically, a 1 week show would be The Best Of hot dogs, and they would come here and do Pink's and then do some Polish sausage in Chicago or whatever. The Best Of steaks, and there's Peter Luger's and, you know, whatever else. And it would be a different, 5 different cities, I think, in each show, all based around one topic, and went all over the country and all over the world, sort of eating and drinking and
Dream gig.
Yeah. So she was doing that while I was in Minneapolis for 3.5 years. And it was then that I, started thinking about other things, you know, other getting out of news. And what would that be? What would I do?
Now, why did you want to get out of news?
I mean, while Fox News, that sort of run and gun bleeds it leads style existed, like it wasn't the way it is now. It wasn't the news wasn't quite as crazy as it is now, but it was getting there. And I was worried that if I kept doing it, that I would have regret. And I was starting to cover a lot of crime and things like that, and having to ask families, you know, how do you feel? Your child has been murdered. You know, that it's not that that isn't important. It's not that those stories shouldn't be told. It just, it was sort of starting to suck away my soul a little bit. And I felt like it's now or never, either like follow this dream, which was movies, or just, you know, live with regret.
Yeah. No, you feel ghoulish. I mean, I was a police reporter at a couple different newspapers, and I was in Salinas, California.
Uh-huh.
I had to cover drive-bys, and you do, like, you feel like you're doing your job. You're doing what needs to be done, but you still feel like an asshole.
Yeah, exactly.
In that moment.
Yeah, totally. And it's not that it's not, again, like, it's a story, but, and you're even sincere in your, your, you know, desire not to hurt someone mm-hmm. more, pour salt in the wound. But as genuine as you are, you're going to come across as a dick or an insensitive, how do you feel?
Yeah.
Fuck off.
How do you think I feel?
Yeah. You know?
So what finally inspires you to make that leap into trying to become a filmmaker? And how did you decide to go to Columbia?
So I can't point to one moment in journalism. I did have a dream that I wrote down, and I looked at my journal recently. The dream was I was driving somewhere and I ran someone over, and before I got out to help it was like I ran over a kid or something. And before I got out to help, I called the station to have a live truck come to the accident.
Wow. And priorities.
Like, yeah. And Or yeah, basically that was it. And I don't, again, that's not like I woke up from the dream and decided to go to film school.
I sat up in a cold sweat.
But it does point to sort of where my head was at, like mm-hmm. questioning whether I should be doing this or not. And I wanted to go to New York because of, I'd always thought living in New York would be cool. I liked the more indie nature of the New York, both New York film schools, NYU and Columbia, both have much more emphasis on independent filmmaking than UCLA does out here to an extent, but AFI and USC are kind of more Hollywood-based, kind of big-budget filmmaking kind of training grounds. And so it was all New York. I didn't even apply to any schools out here.
Mm-hmm. So Columbia Film School is a really great film school and really hard to get into.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah. I mean, it's an amazing school and it was, I didn't think I would get in honestly and did and was immediately like, great, we're moving to New York. Like without even thinking really through it.
What did Jill say?
Jill was thrilled.
Yeah.
Like Jill was fully supportive and was going to support me through film school and help pay for it and everything like that. Everyone else is like, why would you do this? You have a great job at a great station and, you know, a career trajectory that you'll end up at the network. If you stay at this in 5 years, you can do that. Why would you quit midstream? And I think the secret to a lot of decisions people make is you don't fully think through them and don't think about the odds because, you know, it would be crippling, I think, if you thought, oh, what are the chances that I'll ever make it? And so many people said, he's a fucking idiot for doing this. Like told Jill that her
really?
A bunch of people she worked with. Why would he do this? So stupid.
That's
as
awful.
As if he's going to make it, you know, honestly. And I love that stuff. I love that. That fuels me, that kind of thing. The kind of I'll show you. Attitude, which is partly delusional because who knows who's going to make it or not, or get work or whatever. It's all, I mean, it's a combination of things, but I think to make that leap, you kind of have to be a little bit like, fuck off. I'll do whatever
right.
I want. Don't tell me what to do.
You have to believe in yourself somewhat and be able to sell it. And you did, clearly. And Jill's a really adventurous chick.
I mean,
she has climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. You guys have run multiple marathons.
Yeah.
Like, she's traveled the world. So I can imagine that she's like, yeah, let's go to New York.
100%.
Yeah.
Like, I think about that a lot, how she didn't blink. It's like, great, we're moving. Mm-hmm. We had a great house in our apartment in Minneapolis. And, you know, moving to New York, as you know, is mm-hmm. not an easy thing. And with no friends there and no real plan other than we're going to do this and figure it out.
Yeah. And you moved in right after we did into our loft in Brooklyn. This is like 2003, I want to say.
Yeah. We were in Manhattan you had been in Williamsburg. We were on the Upper West Side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We moved 3 weeks before September 11th.
Oh, yeah. I was there September 11th also. I was in Williamsburg, yeah.
Yeah.
And Chris moved there right afterward. Chris came and joined me right afterward. He was stuck in Dallas under contract in Dallas.
Right.
So good times. So we're all in the same loft building. We're like a block and a half from Prospect Park, which was an amazing setting. We're surrounded by weirdos. You are going up to Columbia every day and you're working on your films. What is the philosophy like at Columbia as far as how you learn different things? Because I know that like UCLA and USC philosophically are very different. Like
right.
UCLA, everybody works on everybody's film. You learn how to do every job.
Yeah.
Whereas USC, they try to prime you for the real world and it's more cutthroat.
Right.
How does it work at Columbia?
Columbia is much more like you describe UCLA,
okay.
where especially the first year, I don't think you decide on your concentration, whether it's screenwriting, directing, producing, or criticism.
Mm-hmm.
Theory and criticism. Which Andrew Saris was from, you know, Columbia.
There you go. So he turned out fine.
About the auteur theory, which is, I think, a bit problematic, but that's okay.
Okay.
So we worked on each other's shorts and, you know, made probably 20 short films the first year, just working on, I shot a lot of them and was editing a lot of stuff and we would act in each other's films and stuff like that. Then the second year you get more focused in your concentration, which I was a directing concentration, but also took all the screenwriting classes. And then you get a little more focused in the kinds of stories you're telling. And so it's all about doing everything, you know, like I was production designer on things and, you know, was a assistant director and produced a bunch of things and really kind of just learned by doing. And even jobs that I didn't even know, like I didn't even know exactly what a production designer was supposed to do because we never had one. So we just designed our own sets and stuff ourselves without ever really working with someone who is a great production designer.
I would think it would help you too to have come in with a television production background in terms of knowing how to shoot things, knowing how to edit things, knowing how to write a story.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I was more advanced with the camera than a lot of people coming in because I had shot a bunch of stuff and was familiar with techniques and had been a photographer myself. So I was at an advantage sort of technically speaking over a lot of people. But then you realize very quickly it's a minute and a half news package is real different than a 90-minute or 100-page script or whatever that, yeah, they all have a beginning, middle, and end. But you know, if your news story falls apart at 45 seconds and the rest of it is lame, it's 45 seconds. If your movie falls apart at page 60, you've got another hour of like, shit, we got to figure this out.
So you win the Coen Brothers Award for your short film.
Farrelly Brothers.
Oh, that was the Coen Brothers.
No. I worked with the Coen brothers later, but it was the Farrelly brothers.
Chris
actually
tells the story wrong all the time.
He does.
Chris has been telling everyone that you won a Coen Brothers Award.
Oh.
But you won a Farrelly Brothers Award, which is also a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wait, so what is it? Was that for Flightless Birds?
Yeah. Yeah.
So what does that come with then when you win that?
It came with a $5,000 check.
That helps.
And I wrote them a thank you note and never heard from them. And I actually met Peter Farrelly at one of these things. I'm like, you gave me a bunch of money. Like, thanks, man. Like, oh yeah, I remember meeting you. No, you don't. You definitely did not. Nor did you write me back.
But that must have helped somewhat though, as far as like in pushing you into the real world, you get out of film school and then like, what does one do once you get out of film school?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean the ideally the short becomes like a calling card and you would have this piece of work that you can show people, oh, I can direct and whatever. And then I had a script, a feature script that I had written as well. And so these two things, like here's my directing, here's my writing. This is what I want to do. And one of my teachers was this guy, Jerry Cass, who died a few years ago, was a mentor and one of the all-time great guys. And his wife is Delia Ephron.
Oh, right.
Who
Jill is friends with.
Yeah, yeah. We're great friends with them. And Delia put me in touch with her manager, like a junior manager at the time, which was like 14 years ago. And she liked my film and liked the script and was just like, all right, you're weird. I don't know exactly what to do with you, but let's figure something out. And so really that was my break.
Okay. And then is Cedar Rapids the first major film that you write that gets produced?
Yes.
Okay. Yep. So for the world who has not seen Cedar Rapids, which actually is a great reflection of your sensibility.
Yeah.
Cedar Rapids.
It's probably closer in terms of a more of an accurate representation of the kinds of the scope of movie I thought I would be doing than the big animated things that I've done lately.
So for folks who may not have seen it, what's it about?
It's about a guy from a teeny town in Wisconsin who goes to an insurance convention in Cedar Rapids, thinking that that's like, it's like a Vegas movie with very low stakes, basically.
But who all is in it, though?
It's Ed Helms and John C. Reilly and Anne Heche and Sigourney Weaver and Isaiah Whitlock. It's an amazing cast. And weirdly, Ed now lives on our street and is one of my good friends. And I've done now three movies with John C. Reilly. It's like from that little thing, I've really found a family, like a family of collaborators. Jim Burke, who produced it with Alexander Payne, did Green Book. And, you know, he's still a great friend and like all from that first movie.
That's so funny. So John C. Reilly, so are you talking to him at this point and keeping in touch with him about the possibility of working together again? Like when you begin Wreck-It Ralph. Was he always a person in mind for that? Okay.
Yeah, and on the set of Cedar Rapids, I told him about it. I said, I've written this animated movie. We're going to offer you the lead part in it. And he's like, okay. And he didn't want to do it. Like
he didn't?
No.
Why not?
Not at first. I think John was very nervous about being alone in a dark room and recording into a mic by himself.
I wonder why.
Not literally being in a dark room, yeah. But to him, acting is reacting. And if he just was alone in the booth and wasn't able to work off of another actor, he's like, what's the point? Why would I do that? I don't want to do that. And so we're like, well, when we cast Sarah Silverman, we'll just have you guys do it together. And that became sort of the secret sauce of working with John and all of the actors. Everyone preferred it.
It's unusual to have that luxury, though, to have everybody recording together, though, right?
Yeah, okay. It doesn't, partly because of schedules and it's done over so many years, you can't, it's tricky kind of scheduling everything with actors, but it's, if you can do it, it's obviously way better because you get, it's where the magic comes from.
Right, and if you look at a lot of John T. Reilly's films, you know there's that, the crazy energy of the improv, right?
Yeah.
Walk Hard, for example, is an absolute favorite of ours.
Yeah.
And so much of that you can tell it's like long-time sketch comedy people just playing off of each other.
Yeah. Man, that movie is so good.
It's so underappreciated.
So underrated. Mm-hmm. That bums me out.
We quote Walk Hard and sing songs from Walk Hard around this house all the time. Yeah. So if you need to get your Walk Hard fixed, come on over.
Yeah, no, I'm the same. I always refer to cocaine as cocaine.
You don't want none of that. So let's talk about the difference between writing for a live action film and writing for animation. Or is there one? I mean, in terms of the way you tell the story that you tell, the way you develop the characters you develop, is it very similar or is it a totally different beast?
I would say the development of it is identical, where for me, and it's a big Columbia thing, starting with character and building out from there, like, so very inside out, which is, I some people do it that way. I think most people probably start with here's an idea for a zombie movie or whatever, like that. So I always start with character and do a lot of sort of just deep digging on who is this person, what is this, and find the story that way. Obviously, like with Cedar Rapids, it's going to be a small town guy who goes to Cedar Rapids. That was my first idea. And with Ralph, it was like, there's a bad guy in this video game. He's a real shit disturber. No one likes him. And he wants to be a good guy. So that's the central idea. But then before I ever get too deep into, the plot mechanics or anything like that, it's all like background work on the character and build it from there. And I think both in live action and animation, it's the same exact thing, really, where I start. The big difference is, because there are so many people working in animation and storyboard artists in particular in the early development, you have way more drafts because there are more people who are putting they're giving their input into what the story should be. And so I take what they give me and then rewrite based on that. And then they come back and it's a lot of back and forth. The collaboration is much deeper in animation.
It takes a long time.
Real long time.
I feel like I haven't really seen you and talked to you in 7 years.
I know. It has been. It's been like five basically from the first Ralph to, well, I guess that did come out 7 years ago, but to Zootopia and then not a break between Zootopia and the second Ralph movie.
So how do you, because you have this really specific, really beautifully twisted sense of humor, how do you maintain your voice within a behemoth project like this when there is so much back and forth, when there are so many more collaborators? Yeah. How do you maintain that authentic, truthful nugget of who you are within the behemoth machinery?
Right. It's probably the hardest part, honestly, because when the production is rolling, it's 500 people, literally over 500 people working on the movie. And because it is such a collaborative medium, you want to listen to everybody. So I've said this before and it's true. I had over 30,000 pages of notes on Ralph Breaks the Internet.
From whom?
So every time there's a meeting, there's someone transcribing the verbatim notes, and those are then sent to me. Now, I don't read them, but I've been in that meeting, you know, and
you're like, oh, that's a great idea. Sure. Moving on.
Yeah. But, and every time you screen the movie, we do like 8 or 9 iterations of the movie in rough forms over the years. And people are allowed to send in notes. Every single person in the studio who sees it is given a voice to send their notes. And so it's really valuable because a good note can come from anywhere. And Rich Moore, my partner on these movies, has a good analogy. Like, it's like if you're driving along and an engine light comes on and, you know, the change oil or check oil light comes on and you ignore it. Well, getting a note, if you get the same note a couple of times and you choose to ignore it, chances are your engine's going to blow up. So I actually, you know, it's very valuable. But the trick is when you are buried in 30,000 pages of notes, to your point, how do you maintain kind of the spine of what you want? And I think it's just reminding yourself constantly, why are you making this movie? What is the tone? Who are we within Disney in particular, because it's such a specific brand and we kind of prefer to live a little bit as outliers in the tonal comedic sense and just never forget that. And so understanding that some of our colleagues might not like what we're doing and being okay with that, like, all right, well, you can put that in your movie, but we're doing this one in ours.
Well, like with Ralph Breaks the Internet, I was totally shocked at how much you got away with the princess scene, for example.
Yeah.
Like making fun of the most sacred,
right,
valuable,
yeah, yeah,
pieces, like the commodities within the Disney empire. How, right, did you guys do that?
I mean, it goes back to delusion. Like it didn't occur to us that anyone would say no. I mean, we had to vet that. You know, we had to take that all the way to the top at Disney and say, we're doing this. Are you okay with it? And it was blessed. It was like, everyone else takes the piss out of Disney. Why, we should do it from the inside. And knowing that it's going to be a satirical, funny scene, but there's also this abiding love and respect for the characters. So it's kind of, to me, it's the best kind of satire, when you're not just eviscerating somebody and being nasty and horrible, but you're doing it and shining a light on some things that are a little weird or funny or fucked up. And then underneath it all is a real respect and love.
Right. And you can't depict them in a negative way. I mean, Disney still has to sell dolls and,
sure,
t-shirts and backpacks and all,
yeah,
that.
And no, and that wouldn't, you know, that was never the intent. I don't think.
So I'm jumping ahead though. You and Rich Moore have worked together now on 3 films.
Mm-hmm.
What is that partnership like? Like, who does what? How do you guys decide if you're at an impasse? How do you decide how to work through that? Mm-hmm. What's that relationship like?
We met on the first Ralph. He had read a script of mine called Jeremy Orme is a Pervert, which was a spec script I had written that was a real hard R comedy. But which is interesting. That's what got me in the door at Disney.
That's who you are.
Yeah. But Rich had been a Simpsons director in Futurama and had just started at Disney. And we hit it off just from a sensibility standpoint. You know, he's more of a, you know, those shows represent kind of his sense of humor. And we just hit it off and liked each other right away and developed the first movie. And it was much more, the first Ralph was my first foray into animation. And so I was mainly just focused on the writing and working with the story artists, the storyboard artists. And it wasn't really until Zootopia that I got much more involved in the filmmaking parts of it, where I was, you know, helping cut the movie and working with actors a lot more and, you know, doing more of the directing kind of work with, you know, again, he's a real, kind of democratic, the more the merrier in Rich's world. And so he was cool about having me around and seeking my input. And then on this one, we were full partners and
you co-directed, co-wrote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he, really never, anytime there was an impasse, it would usually be the best idea wins. And so you bring it up in the room and, you know, there are a dozen story artists and a producer and people. And what do you guys think? It would always go that way.
When you guys are making Wreck-It Ralph, did it occur to you in the doing of the thing that it would become a phenomenon?
Oh, the first one?
Yes.
I don't think so. I mean, Disney was really, I guess, Tangled. No, when we started, Tangled hadn't come out. So Disney had had a run of not terribly successful things. They were, you know, it was before John Lasseter and Ed Catmull had come in, and they had just come in when we were hired. And so, you know, the string of 10 years of really great films, they had sort of a lull before that. So there were virtually no expectations when we started.
Which is probably kind of great.
It's awesome. Uh-huh. It really is. I mean, yeah, so coming at it from sort of an underdog standpoint, and then, you know, again, not thinking one way or the other. Is it going to be successful? Is it not? I don't know. Like, it's weird how you compartmentalize these things as you're going.
Sequel hadn't even occurred to people.
No, never, never.
Which I think a lot of these films begin as part of a franchise, right? We're going to do a three-film deal with this character.
And
but that wasn't even in the gleam of the eye at that point.
No.
Okay.
No. Uh-uh.
So that must have felt really great then when it was, you know, universally loved.
Yeah. I mean, I guess.
Do you read reviews?
Some. Mm-hmm. I read your reviews.
I don't review your movies anymore.
I know. But generally I read your reviews.
Thank you.
I read, there are a handful of critics mm-hmm. whose opinion I really respect, mm-hmm. you being one of them, others that I find it's a waste of time. Including some of your partners.
Okay. We won't have to name any names. That's fine. So let's talk about Zootopia, because I think Zootopia is a great example of you bringing that wisdom and that bite of your voice to material that might have been kind of mawkish.
Yeah, yeah.
You gave that a spine and a bite. How did you do that?
I mean, that's like satire or... which I guess there are satiric elements of Zootopia for sure. And even if it's coming from a place of love, a satire without teeth is the worst thing, you know, without a bite.
Why bother?
And the risk of something like Zootopia they're cute animals talking about racism could go real quickly into Saturday morning cartoon preaching, you know, territory, which no one wants. And it becomes an embarrassment, basically. I think like the bad version of that would have been that. And so it was really pushing the envelope and pushing the tone farther than, you know, crossing the line and then being told to come back, as opposed to not going far enough, which happens more often than not in big budget Hollywood filmmaking, I think.
Why not go for it, though?
Why not do that and then be told, that's a bit much? But there's a lot of things. I remember when I came in on Zootopia and there was a record session with Jason Bateman, and he's reading the new pages going like, oh, we're going for it then, are we? and I was like, yes, exactly. We're going for it. If we're doing a movie about racism and our main character, you know, commits essentially a racist act, yeah, we're going for it. It needs to be that, and it needs to reflect the real world in a way that's not, you know, tap dancing around it. You have to go at it.
That must have felt good, though, to have somebody like Jason Bateman say something like that to you.
Totally. Yeah, yeah. It was risky for sure, but I think again, Disney's people think of it as a big conservative company, but they really just wanted quality and wanted it to be as good as it could be and sort of earn its way into the pantheon.
And Zootopia gets nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah.
For Best Animated Film.
And won.
That's right. It won, didn't it?
Sure did.
That's right.
Yeah.
How did that feel?
Great.
That's right. Duh. That won, didn't it? I'm sorry.
Yeah. Ralph is the one that doesn't win. Nominated across the board, never wins. Poor Ralph.
It's a great film,
poor,
though.
Poor dummy.
It's a great film, though. So Zootopia wins. You're there on Oscar night, right?
Yeah.
You and Jill are there.
Yeah.
How did that feel to hear them say the word Zootopia?
It was awesome. No, it was you know, it's one of those odd, out-of-body experiences where I'd hoped it would win, and I thought it had a chance. Like, we knew Ralph, too, didn't have a chance. And so that was more just, woo, we're going to a party.
Why wasn't Ralph 2 going to win?
Because it's Spider-Man. It's a good, great movie.
Spider-Man, it is very good.
Yes, yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. And like, I have no problem with that. But, like, the experiences were quite different because Zootopia, there was genuine expectation. But there's always a chance it might not win. Whereas with Ralph, it was like, we're not going to win. I didn't even get nervous when they called my name. So I was, that this year was just a blast.
You're like, oh yeah, that's me.
Yeah, right. Totally.
What is that whole experience like though of going through award season? Cause I've been to the Oscars like for a decade. I covered the Oscars, but in the press room next door at the Lowe's Hotel next door to the Dolby Theater. What is it like being in that room and being in the whole award season the whole way through? Is it thrilling? Is it a grind? Is it an honor just to be nominated?
I mean, honest, there is that for mm-hmm. sure. And that part, when it became a grind, I would remind myself of the rare air kind of it all. The part that made it tiring a little bit was our movie came out in November and then, we went around the world promoting it. And so I had been talking a lot about the movie and then there was a couple weeks at Christmas and then right back into promoting the movie and still opening it in parts of Europe and stuff. So it was really just, how can I say things about this movie that I haven't said 1,000 times? And of course, like you have to, just for efficiency's sake, figure out a way to spit out answers and but still try to be engaged with whoever's talking. So the award season bit, again, we weren't going to win. So part of it's like, why am I doing this? But it's also awesome and such a, it is a privilege. Like, that anyone gives a shit what I have to say. Like, I need to show up, right?
Well, so you did travel the world. I recall we would text you and ask you what country you were in today.
Yeah.
And your family came and joined you in Japan, I want to say, for part of it.
Yeah.
What was the best thing you did during your whole Ralph promotional tour?
Oh, man. Japan was amazing. I'd never been. So we were in Tokyo. And then Jill and the kids came and we went up to northern Japan and saw snow monkeys and
amazing.
Went to Kyoto and... That part was fantastic. I mean, London was great, Berlin, Paris, Rome, Madrid. I mean, I hadn't spent any time in Rome. Rome is dope. I love Rome. I would love to go back to Rome.
That's their official tourism motto, by the way.
Rome is dope.
But it's in Italian.
Yeah, yeah.
However you say Rome is dope in Italian.
Yeah, yeah. That would be good on a bumper sticker.
But, like, you love Fellini, though.
I do.
And so was that so extra cool to go to a place like Rome?
Because, yeah. Oh, and I have a picture. There was a Mastroianni, Marcello Mastroianni, Mastroianni, however you pronounce it, exhibit at this museum. And on a bus bench, there's a picture of him from 8 1/2. Mm-hmm. And then in the background, there was this Disney Mickey Mouse thing. So this juxtaposition of my idol, you know, Fellini, you know, one of his films, and then the place I'm working. It was, I loved it.
That is amazing. So you are a parent now. You are a parent as I am.
Yeah.
not a parent, A-P-P-A-R-E-N-T,
yes, right.
But you have
a
children.
Parent, yes.
How is being a father, how does that change the way that you approach what you do or approach your views on art or whatever?
Interestingly, or not, I love it when people start sentences
or not.
With interestingly.
It Here, might be interesting.
Here's what's interesting about that. Maybe not. I find like the things with pushing the tone in kids' entertainment, I think is... Kids, as you know, kids are way smarter than we ever give them credit for. And I am really bugged when an animated film or a family entertainment like does sly sexual innuendo. They're like, oh, the parents are going to get that. And isn't that cool? That's gross and stupid. And no one likes that joke. But they do it all the freaking time. And it's stupid. And it should stop. So... I'm just set going on record saying mm-hmm. that. I think that you can tell a joke that a kid might not get, and that's fine, as long as the story still makes sense. And that sometimes, you know, a fart joke a kid will laugh at, maybe their parents will think, oh, that's puerile or whatever. But that, like, I think there's a world where you can make stuff that... Some of it will fly over the kids' heads, some of it will be below the beneath the parents. But if the story is great and the characters are great, you can kind of find a sweet spot. And we've all been to so many terrible movies on Saturday afternoons that are just a nap. Why not do something that is great for everybody if you can?
Do you listen to feedback from your own kids?
Oh my God, yeah.
Emmett 7, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It might have been the Oscars day.
Oh my God.
I was brushing my teeth and he comes up to me and goes, "Dad, you know what movie you're going to make next?" I'm like, "No, I'm not sure." He goes, "I think you should make Spider-Man 2.
like Sam Raimi Spider-Man 2?
No,
like Andy Garfield?
Like the animated Spider-Man.
Oh, God. Because
he'd like that movie so much.
He likes Spider-Verse?
Much. Yeah. I mean, he likes Ralph better, but like they had just seen Spider-Verse and he's like, "Maybe you should do that." I'm like, "You little bastard, you are not my child."
Maybe there could be some sort of like crossover.
Yeah.
Where one of the dimensions that the Spider-Man comes from is the internet where Ralph and Vanellope are doing their thing. At the beginning of the show, I played a place called Slaughter Race, which is a song that you wrote.
You co-wrote. Yes.
Let's talk about that experience.
Alan Menken, eight Oscars, and sort of defined what Disney sounded like in the 90s, basically. It became a story point where, what if Vanellope sings a song and it's, it should be like a Princess Want song and it should be like an Alan Menken song. And we kept referencing Alan Menken, and then Tom McDougall, who wrote the lyrics with me, and he's a supervisor of music, is like, "I know Alan. Why don't I'll just call Alan and see if he'll do it."
Let's just call Alan.
So he did, and he came in, and we did a lot of back and forth with him, but it's one of those moments that is so out of body, so more so than the Oscars, I would say, because I never anticipated or had a goal of writing music and working with this legend. You know, as we were rehearsing the song the day before we recorded with Sarah Silverman and Alan at this studio in West Hollywood, like they're banging it, he's banging it out on the piano. And then we rehearsed it three times and she's like, "Would you do something from Little Shop of Horrors?" Because that's her favorite musical. Oh. And he gets on the piano and she's singing it. And I can't remember if Suddenly Seymour or Down on Skid Row, I can't remember what song they did, but it was like here I am with one of the greatest comedians living, one of the greatest songwriters, and I'm just sitting there like digging it.
That's magic.
It was awesome. It was really cool.
Alan Menken takes requests.
Yeah, exactly.
He's got like a brandy snifter on the piano.
Well, she was very much, he had his phone out and was having Sarah FaceTime with his children.
Oh my
so
God.
He nerded out on her too.
I guess it was on the Ralph Breaks the Internet Twitter feed. I know you're not on social media anywhere. I don't know how you've managed to elude it thus far, but you have. But they posted some video of a recording session from Slaughter Race.
Oh, wow.
And there's just pure joy like emanating from everyone. She's so adorable.
Yeah.
You can see you in the background just beaming.
Yeah. Yeah. The rehearsal was amazing. Then the day we recorded it with it was a 70-piece orchestra. I mean,
that's incredible.
Now, how does that doesn't happen?
This is a new thing, a new side gig for you.
I loved it. I mean, I kind of want to do a musical.
I can see you doing that.
Great.
Is that like an animated musical?
No, like a Broadway musical.
Wow. What would it be about?
I don't know.
You're not there yet.
I don't know, but it was really fun, and I love the idea of that.
What else is still out there for you storytelling-wise? What else is percolating in your brain?
I still want to get Confederacy of Dunces made.
What is up with that? That's been kicking around for a little while.
Yeah, for like 40 years.
You are a part of this 40-year journey here. Because Zach Galifianakis was going to star in it?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. At one point, that's who I developed it with initially. And then that didn't happen. And I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. But I feel like I want to take one last crack at that.
Okay.
And there's a lot of sort of smaller movies in the Cedar Rapids size that I would love to do. That's just ideas of mine that I've been living with for years. And I've been, as you said, sort of in the Disney world for 5 or so years. So I'm probably going to try to do something a little more intimate and contained and small, next, but I don't know for sure what it is.
The Cedar Rapids Cinematic Universe.
Yes.
Ed Helms goes to Omaha next, different town.
Exactly.
So we're okay, you can go to like Sioux Falls.
Yeah, yeah. All the quad cities.
All the indoor pools in the Midwest.
Yes.
You are wonderful. And we've been talking for an hour, by the way.
Oh, my God.
It flew by. So if you have someplace to be, you're late.
Wow. Jeez, I am late.
It is so good to see you and talk to you.
You too.
I'm so proud. Chris and I are always so proud when we see you. No, because you're hugely talented, but you're still your weird, down-to-earth self. And we appreciate that. And I'm sure it's nice to have some downtime now after, like, days and days
of, like... You have no idea.
16-hour days?
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah.
Of writing, the grueling process. So now it's downtime for a bit. And so I'm thrilled that you gave me an hour of your downtime.
Oh, it was so fun.
So thank you.
I
appreciate it. And we'll do more Breakfast All Day interviews with various random friends of mine. I have Julia Kim, who's a casting director, coming up soon. I have Marcellus Reynolds, who was on Big Brother and Big Brother All-Stars. And he's a star.
Wow.
People recognize him all the time.
Good.
He's got a book coming out about black supermodels.
Cool.
And so he's coming up too, but nobody will have the stories that Phil Johnston has. So
they might. if they listen to this podcast.
They won't be as good.
Plagiarized.
So thank you for hanging out with me. It's good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Bye.